Good afternoon. This is the clerk of the court, Greg Block, confirming procedures for the oral argument scheduled to be conducted by teleconference this afternoon. If arguing counsel or a judge drops from this teleconference, we will pause the proceedings and clock until the judge and or counsel is reconnected. In accordance with the instructions we previously provided counsel, we will sound a single tone that sounds like this. When counsel has 3 minutes remaining in allotted time, and a double tone that sounds like this, when counsel's total allotted time expires. Arguing counsel in this case are on the call. Ms. April Donauer, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Thank you. And Mr. Mark Bichich, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Please stand by while I confirm the judges are on the call. Our presiding judge, Chief Judge Bartley, did you hear both counsel and can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Judge Peach, did you hear both counsel and can you hear me?
Yes, I did. I heard both counsel and I can hear you.
Thank you. And Judge Falvey, did you hear both counsel and can you hear me?
Yes, I did, and I can.
Thank you. Chief Judge Bartley, the call is configured, and all participants are now ready to proceed.
Very good, Colonel Block. You may call the court to order.
The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via teleconference by Judge Peach and Judge Falvey. We're here today for the matter of Clifton Arline versus Robert Wilkie, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 18-765. Before us is the board's denial of a total disability rating based on individual unemployability for Mr. Arline and the board's finding that his employment was not in a protected environment. Counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant counsel.
April Donahauer of Chisholm, Chisholm and Kilpatrick for appellant Clifton Arline. With me on the line is Barbara Cook, also of the firm.
Thank you, Ms. Donahauer and Ms. Cook. And
this is Mark,
Secretary.
Yeah, this is Mark Fidgich with the Secretary's Office of General Counsel. With me on the call today is Sarah Fusina, Deputy Chief Counsel of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Fidgich and Ms. Fusina. Each party will have 30 minutes to present their argument. Ms. Donahauer, do you want to preserve any portion of your time?
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes, please.
Okay, great. We will make that happen. Ms. Donahauer, you may proceed when you're ready.
Chief Judge Bartley, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The board can't simply assume the existence of facts that evidence must establish, but that's what it did to find that the allowances Mr. Arline's employer made for him were implausible on their face. Nothing but the board's speculation suggests that Mr. Arline's boss did not do his work for him and fix his mistakes. The vocational expert opined that this was the only way Mr. Arline could work at a level above marginal, because the only evidence from a competent source shows that substantially gainful work was only possible through unreasonable accommodations like these, the board's finding that Mr. Arline's work environment was not protected was contrary to law and clearly erroneous. Accordingly, the court should reverse the board's denial of TDIU. Determining whether an employer would plausibly provide the accommodations Mr. Arline's boss and coworkers reportedly did required vocational evidence. Certain determinations about what happens in the workplace are beyond the board's competence, just like certain medical determinations. And we know that from this court's decisions in Kahana in Miller and the Federal Circuit's decision in Jandro. If that's the case, if the determination is beyond the board's confidence, then it needs independent evidence from a qualified source to decide what would plausibly happen. Here, there was such evidence, the vocational expert's opinion, and she agreed that an employer would plausibly be more than generous, as Mr. Arline's boss was, and provide accommodations that incurred an unreasonable burden on business. And there was no evidence from a competent source to the contrary, either as to whether these accommodations were plausible or as to whether they were unreasonable. In that regard, the VA examiner simply assumed that the veteran's employment was substantially gainful, or in other words, that the accommodations he received were unreasonable. And the board, for its part, speculated that no employer in the marketplace would provide the accommodations that Mr. Arline reportedly received and consistently reported throughout the record. But it lacked evidence and indeed relied only on its own opinion that an employer wouldn't provide these accommodations. And so there's no plausible basis in the record for its determination that his work environment was not protected. It was also contrary to law for the board to make this finding without competent evidence for it to rest on. Notably, the board did not question Ms. Grundin, the vocational expert's qualifications as a vocational expert, or the adequacy of her opinion, including its reasoning. It only questioned the underlying facts about whether accommodations were in fact provided to Mr. Arline. So setting aside the board's erroneous determination that those accommodations were not provided, the only evidence is the vocational expert's opinion that those accommodations rendered his work environment protected. And so there's no additional fact finding to be conducted here, and therefore reversal of the board's denial of TDIU is appropriate.
Now, Ms. Donahoe, this is Judge Bartley. Are we bound here by our conclusion in Cantrell that the phrase employment in a protected environment is ambiguous, or does Kaiser affect that?
Judge Bartley, I think that the legal landscape has changed since Cantrell, including because of Kaiser, as Your Honor just mentioned, to the extent that the court is not bound by that determination. Furthermore, not only is there Kaiser, but there's also the Ray decision that's been handed down in the meantime. So we now can look at what substantially gainful employment means in order to help determine what a protected work environment is. And additionally, in Kaiser, as Your Honor implied, the Supreme Court referred to the threshold analysis and clarified what that has to include before a regulation can be deemed to be ambiguous. And based on the analysis that the Kaiser court set out and what we have here in terms of the plain language of 4.16, the history of the regulation, the interpretation of other terms within the regulation and its purpose, taking a new look at the phrase in a protected environment should lead to the court determining that it's not, in fact, ambiguous, that it's clear. And the clear meaning of that phrase is a workplace in which a veteran's employer, it includes a workplace in which a veteran's employer provides unreasonable accommodations of his or her service-connected limitations. Knowing what we know
Ms. Donahoe, yeah. This is Judge Bartley. So you're saying that the regulation is not ambiguous. And then you seem to be adding in, though, some language that is not on the – you talked about the plain language of 4.16. You seem to be adding in, though, factors that aren't actually listed in the plain language, like unreasonable accommodation. Talk to me about that. Where are you getting that? And does that fit with your statement that the regulation is not ambiguous?
It does, for a few reasons. We know that when the inquiry is into whether marginal employment exists on a facts-bound basis, we've eliminated the economic inquiry into what is substantially gainful employment. So we're looking here just at the non-economic inquiry, that is, whether a veteran is capable of the physical and mental acts required by substantially gainful employment, as the court explained in Ray. So if a veteran is able to meet those physical and mental requirements, he or she is capable of substantially gainful employment. If he or she is not able to meet those requirements and is still nevertheless working in a job despite the inability to meet its requirements, and the employer makes up for that gap, then the veteran is being protected from the consequences of his or her inability to meet the requirements of substantially gainful employment. So knowing what we know about what substantially gainful employment is, a protected environment is protection against the consequences of that inability. Now as to
Ms. Donna Howard, this is Judge Bartley. If we use the accommodations, or as you say, unusual or extraordinary accommodations as our gauge, how would a veteran demonstrate that the accommodations were extraordinary? And given that the Americans with Disabilities Act covers the issue of accommodations, how would what role would the ADA standard play, and how would adjudicators work through that?
The ADA comes in when it comes to looking at reasonable versus unreasonable accommodations. And as Your Honor previously asked, how does this concept of unreasonable accommodations come into the interpretation of protected environment? It's because under the ADA, the provision of reasonable accommodations means that an individual is qualified. So a qualified individual is one who, with or without reasonable accommodations, can meet the demands of the job. So it follows that if an employee is only receiving reasonable accommodations, he or she is qualified for the job and therefore qualified for substantially gainful work. It changes if those accommodations are unreasonable because they go beyond what the law already requires of the employer. So at that point, the employer is protecting the employee against the consequences of his inability or her inability to meet the demands of the job. So it's going above and beyond what the law already requires and is therefore protective.
I was going to follow up and say, how would you establish that you were protected from the economic consequences?
So if the veteran is working as he or she would be, if this inquiry is being conducted, the analysis would look into what are the requirements of the job that he or she is doing, the essential functions of the job. What is the veteran unable to do because of his or her service-connected disability? And what is the employer doing, and is it protecting the veteran from that gap between what he or she is able to do and what is required of him or her? And then is that protection beyond what's required by law as a reasonable accommodation? And that will, what is reasonable is, of course, a fact-specific analysis and a case-by-case analysis.
And what is it that you, this is Judge Bartley and Ms. Donna Hauer, what is it that you object to about the Secretary's proposed definition of a non-competitive workplace separate from the open labor market in which a hiring decision is motivated by benevolence?
It's inconsistent with the plain language of the regulation to start with. And the reason for that is because it shrinks what a protected environment is defined as down to simply one of the examples that's provided in the regulation, and that makes the phrase "such as" in the regulation superfluous and eliminates other paths to showing a protected environment. So it's contrary to the language of the regulation. And additionally, it's contrary to the regulation as a whole, given what we know about what substantially gainful employment requires, because it looks to the state of mind of the employer, and it looks to the nature of the workplace rather than what the veteran is or is not capable of doing and what is being done to meet the gap between that level of functioning and the requirements of the job. And it's also contrary to the purpose of the regulation, which is to make up for a veteran's ability or inability to earn, which, again, has to be determined by reference to what he or she is capable of doing, as the court set forth in Ray. So it has to involve some inquiry into the veteran's capabilities and the employer's act vis-a-vis those capabilities, and not just at the nature of the workplace or whether the employer's attitude is benevolent. I think the employer's attitude could play a role in the analysis. And in fact, in this case, Mr. Arline's supervisor was a veteran himself and was understanding of Mr. Arline's difficulties, and that in part motivated the allowances he made for Mr. Arline's limitations. But at the end of the day, the relevant inquiry here is, what did he do for Mr. Arline based on what Mr. Arline himself was unable to do? If the court disagrees that the regulation is clear and not ambiguous, we would argue that the secretary's interpretation isn't entitled to deference anyway. I just got into that to some extent by explaining how it's inconsistent with the regulation. But it also, as Your Honor knows, is a change of position from the one that was advanced in Cantrell. It's advanced for the first time in the Secretary's supplemental pleading here. And indeed, it's a narrower interpretation than the board's interpretation in its decision in this case, in which the board accepted that unreasonable accommodations could constitute a protected environment. And in that regard, it's generally inconsistent with board members' interpretation of the phrase, which generally are an accommodation-based understanding of what happens in the workplace. If there are no further questions from Your Honors, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Judge Peach, do you have any further questions?
Yes, I just have one question. The workplace, under the ADA, the employer makes reasonable accommodations for the employee. Then you're advancing on, or are you advancing on top of the reasonable accommodations, that there would be unreasonable accommodations as well given to the employee?
What I'm arguing is that is yes. essentially, and it's the unreasonableness of the accommodation that's provided that renders the work environment protected, because reasonable accommodations are already required by law.
So it would be, okay, so there would be a point of reasonable versus unreasonable, but could they ever meld into one and all become reasonable?
No, Your Honor. There's a distinction between unreasonable and reasonable accommodations. Where that line lies has to be based on vocational evidence. So in this case, the vocational expert explained that the types of accommodations that Mr. Arline's employer was providing put an unreasonable burden on the company and would not generally be provided in a competitive work environment and rendered them unreasonable. So since they went beyond the types of accommodations that the law would otherwise require, they were unreasonable and rendered the work environment protected.
What were those unreasonable accommodations?
Mr. Arline was sometimes simply unable to complete his assignments, and as his schizophrenia worsened, he made more and more mistakes over time. So not only his supervisor, but also his coworkers sometimes did his work for him outright, or they fixed his mistakes. In addition to that, he was allowed to choose his schedule in order to accommodate his drowsiness and his aversion to being around others, allowed to miss work, allowed to take breaks at will, even allowed to oversleep his lunch break, which he was allowed to nap during.
Do you know whether any of those accommodations were justified through like a use of leave or a alternate hours for work? Or was this something that it was whenever he wanted, anytime he wanted, and that the employer had no say about it?
I think the short answer is yes. Initially, he was using accrued leave to take some of those absences, but at a certain point, it's not clear whether that leave ran out. And under the ADA, an adjusted work schedule and time off, depending on the facts of the case, can be reasonable. But Mr. Arline's increased and remained persistent over time. And he was also doing things like taking naps whenever he wanted to and for as long as he wanted to without being disciplined by his employer. And I think the most salient accommodation here as far as unreasonableness goes is that his coworkers and boss were doing his work for him and fixing his mistakes, which really goes to the essential functions of his job. They were doing the substance of his job for him.
Thank you.
Judge Salvi, do you have any further questions?
I do, thank you. Ms. Donahauer, the vocational expert's testimony, was that based on anything other than the claims and statements of the appellant?
It was not, as far as the factual underpinnings of what happened in the workplace, but it was insofar it was based on her expertise about what happens in the workplace and what employers do.
Okay. Does the court reach the question of what protected environment means if they find that the board didn't clearly err in finding Mr. Arline not credible?
think it should, Your Honor. But could you? I want to be certain that I understand your question. Could you please rephrase?
Well, I think that the board found Mr. Artline not credible, and if the board did not err in that finding, do we need to reach the? There's in essence, no evidence of these accommodations, and we don't need to reach the question of whether these accommodations were reasonable, unreasonable, or whether this, what he describes, constitutes a protected environment or not, or do it.
I think the court does need to reach that, and the reason is that Mr. Artline's statements are not the only evidence that these accommodations happened. The vocational expert's endorsement of them, based on her knowledge.
You just told me that was based solely on his statements also. So if his statements are not credible,
What happened?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
I clarified that her opinion was based on both what he reported and on her expertise. So based on her expertise, she did not question the veracity or plausibility of what he reported. So, and this is similar to the discussions in Kahana and in Miller, as Your Honor knows, about how an opinion based on expertise can inform the board's assessment of credibility here. And here we have someone who knows what happens in the workplace who didn't question and didn't decline to give an opinion based on Mr. Artline's reports of what happened. And in the face of that, all we have the board saying is we speculate that this, in fact, did not happen, despite the fact that someone with vocational knowledge accepted that it did.
Right.
And I think...
Go ahead.
I'm finished, Your Honor. Go ahead.
It's a lot of the plausibility of what he says kind of runs in the face of, you know, kind of the understanding of what the nature of federal employment is. It is by definition competitive, competitive hiring, you know, merit-based, et cetera, and the employees are. Federal employees are put on performance standards that are measurable and articulable, and then at the end of each year, you're evaluated on those. And, I believe Mr. Artline was an employee of the Department of Defense, so there's ethics regulations that govern the requirement that one provide a full day's work for their wages that they're earning, and you'd have to find him credible. You'd have to believe that not only was his supervisor ignoring these other regulations, but his coworkers were as well. Is the board not entitled to make such a determination? I guess another way of asking that is can someone who's a federal employee ever be considered to be working in a protected environment?
No, Your Honor, and I would respectfully disagree with the premise that his government, Mr. Artline's government employment categorically cuts against a finding that allowances were made for him here. In fact, in my preparation for today, I came across a case that I would be happy to submit a supplemental authority that talks about how because a government employer might have the resources to bend over backwards, I think that was the court's language in the case, to go above and beyond what the law requires in terms of accommodations, doesn't mean that they should be held to be reasonable or required. And similarly, I think that it doesn't mean they should be held to be implausible on their face. In fact, I believe the federal government has an admirable policy of helping veterans out, and it's certainly not implausible to think that a fellow veteran as a supervisor would understand where another veteran was coming from and make allowances for him. And there's no evidence here that it was taxing on the resources of the employer to the extent of implausibility. Of course, it was a tax on it to the extent that it was unreasonable, but the board didn't have evidence to say it went beyond that into the realm of implausibility.
Sure, but what if bending over backwards were itself a violation of the law? This is a hypothetical question. I'm not saying that happened here, but...
I would just say I think in general we don't want to disincentivize employers helping someone to have the dignity of going to work despite difficulty arising from service connected disability.
Well, of course not, but if you know, it seems to me that the federal employer, when faced with a accommodation request, they're obligated to reasonably accommodate, and if they go too far, they run the risk of what you call bending over backwards. They go too far, they run the risk of then rendering their workplace a protected environment. And categorizing the employment as marginal, they worry about stigmatizing. That seems to be as great a risk. So you'd be putting the employer in the position of, we've got to do what is reasonable and no more. Again, this is hypothetical concerns, but it seems to me, you know, it kind of goes back to Judge Bartley's questions about the intersection between this and the ADA.
Certainly, and if what Your Honor is getting at is whether there are limits here, I would agree that there are limits here, but whether there's a categorical limitation on unreasonable accommodations to help the veterans, I would say no. There could be extreme situations where the provided accommodation is in fact implausible, or as Your Honor suggested, that I don't want to speculate on where it strays into illegality, but this is not a situation, for example, where Mr. Arline was being paid a full salary to just stay home, to do nothing. He was coming in each day, trying to do his job, falling short, and his employer and coworkers were making up the gap. And it's admirable that they did so, and not implausible. And certainly, there's no evidence here that it didn't happen. Just the board's conjecture.
Well, I thank you. I appreciate you letting me run my stream of consciousness here for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Donna Howard, this is Judge Bartley. Just to clarify, was there any evidence in the record or any reference by the board to federal employment rules about, you know, performance evals or annual reviews or things like that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Okay. It sounds like that's the end of our questions here. So thank you, Ms. Donna Hauer. Mr. Vichich, you may proceed when ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley, and may it please the court. This again is Mark Vichich on behalf of the Secretary. The Department of Veterans Affairs has long awarded total disability ratings to veterans who are so disabled from their service-connected disabilities that they are unable to secure or follow substantially gainful employment. In 1990, the Secretary added an income standard to his total disability rating criteria. An income standard is objective and easy to apply uniformly. But income does not always tell the complete story of a person's workplace capabilities. The Secretary therefore adopted a facts-found exception. As an example of when the facts justify finding that the person's employment was not substantially gainful, the Secretary identified employment in a protected environment, such as a family business or sheltered workshop. Appellant is asking the court to interpret this portion of the regulation broadly so that his former employment with the Defense Supply Center of Columbus qualifies as work in a protected environment. The Secretary is asking the court to reject that argument for either of two reasons. First, regardless of which party has the better interpretation of the regulation, the board's factual findings preclude applying that regulation here. Second, and in the alternative, the better interpretation of the phrase in a protected environment is a far narrower interpretation than what appellant offered. The Secretary today will address two issues. The first, he will address the credibility issue raised in this case, which was the subject of the court's vacated memorandum decision. And then second, the Secretary will discuss the meaning of the term protected environment in light of the text, structure, history, and purpose of Section 4.16. With that, I'll begin with the credibility determination. The board here rejected the September 2017 vocational assessment because it rejected the factual premise underlying that opinion. The board rejected the appellant's descriptions of the extent of his workplace accommodations as not credible. The board relied on the inherently incredible characteristics of those assertions. The board relied on the affirmative evidence explaining the reason for the termination, which was a regular retirement. And the board relied on the length of the employment. The veteran was there for 37 years. This is a classic factual assessment subject to the clearly erroneous standard of review. The court's memorandum decision broke no new ground. The memorandum decision just applied the existing case law to the facts of this case and determined that the board's factual findings are plausible. The Secretary is asking the court to again affirm the board's denial of TDIU based on that application of the clearly erroneous standard.
Now, Mr. Vichich, this is Judge Bartley. You were laying out the three reasons that the board gave for finding the veteran's story not credible. Does the veteran need anything other than his own statement to describe what happened in his workplace? And relatedly, I mean, unless he's saying, like, green men from Mars landed and helped me out with my work, I find the inherently incredible a little over the top, to be perfectly honest. So could you just explain those two things?
Well, sure. This board decision was a pretty long decision and gave a thorough analysis. But looking at the whole decision and the entire record, the board explained how it looked at the descriptions of the veteran's workplace. The descriptions that he gave when he submitted the September 2017 vocational report were a little different than other. This was the first time he had described in such detail the extent of nature of these of the workplace accommodations. And Judge Falvey indicated that it does strain credibility, as the board put it, that the workplace that they would go so far out of the way, not just these minor accommodations, but to go that far. And that is, as I said, something completely within the board's province to make. A veteran, in some cases, the board might have required corroborating evidence, but in this case, the board determined that the veteran's self-serving statements just were not sufficient to provide that factual finding. So, and that's what the court has already determined, and it's now vacated decision. And the Secretary is asking the court to issue a decision that is a lot like the first one.
This is Judge Bartman, Mr. Vicich. I guess it's all in the way it's presented. I mean, if you present it as six supervisors lie on their annual reviews as to Mr. Arline, then it might possibly get to inherently incredible, although, I'm not certain about that. But if you phrase it as did at least one supervisor and maybe some coworkers want to allow a long-term employee who had apparently given many years of faithful federal service some leeway as his disability that was due to service became worse, then that does not strain credibility, implausibility rather. So I guess it's a matter of perspective here and how it's presented. But my question is to whether he would need any backup or additional evidence as to describing what happened in his workplace. I didn't catch your answer on that.
Well, I think it depends on what the board says, because this is a factual issue for the board to determine. Is there a case where the board might accept a statements that are uncorroborated? Sure, maybe that in a certain case the board does accept them, but the board did not accept those statements here, and we're asking the court to affirm that finding based on this record before the court.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
I do not have any other points to make on the credibility portion. If there are no other questions from the court, I'm going to dive right into the meaning of the word the term protected environment. Okay. Turning to the language of Section 4.16, the Secretary is asking to hold that the term protected environment means a non-competitive workplace separated from workplaces in the open labor market, and in which hiring and compensation decisions are motivated by a benevolent attitude toward the employee. The examples in the regulation are a useful starting point, a family business and sheltered workshop. Both of these examples suggest a workplace in which hiring and compensation decisions are motivated by an employer's desire to help the employee rather than to obtain the valuable skills of the employee. And both of those examples suggest a workplace that is separated from those in the open competitive job market. Importantly, the Secretary was not the first agency to use the term protected environment. The Internal Revenue Service and the Social Security Administration both have used that term before the Secretary did, and they used that term to describe as a component of a sheltered workshop. The specialized text in the area of disability rehabilitation similarly used the phrase protected environment or some variation of it to discuss a workplace that's segregated from a competitive work environment. And those examples indicate that what this protected environment exception is a very narrow one. Not only that, but the history and purpose of the exception and the regulation support that view. Again, the income standard was added to increase consistency in TDIU adjudications. Interpreting the exception broadly would frustrate the purpose of the regulation because a level of subjectivity would be introduced into the analysis. Individual adjudicators would not know where to draw the line, where a regular accommodation becomes something so excessive that it is now a protected environment. Essentially, the exception would swallow the rule if the exception is as broad as the appellant offers. We also point to the purpose of the regulation. The purpose of this regulation is to compensate veterans who are not able to work in substantially gainful occupations. This veteran did. He worked in a substantially gainful occupation for 37 years. At the time of his regular retirement, he was earning five times the income threshold. And the regulation is the purpose of the regulation is to compensate people who are not able to work in that sort of environment. And that's why the Secretary is asking.
Mr. Vicic, this is Judge Bartley. Let me just stop you there. So you emphasize in your briefs, et cetera, that he made so much over the poverty level. Now, the definition of a protected environment as it includes a family business certainly would not preclude, let's say, Warren Buffett's cousin, who he's paying. I probably shouldn't mention anyone directly, but this is just a hypothetical, of course. His cousin, who he's paying $200,000 a year to, you know, do some work maybe that
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Did you have a question? I did not hear a question. Hello?
This is Judge Falvey. I think maybe we lost Chief Judge Bartley.
Okay, I will stand by.
We'll call to stand by then and give her a moment to be heard.
Judge Bartley. Yes. Michael, can you hear me? Okay, yes, I don't know what happened. I'm back on live. Okay, Mr. Vicic.
Yes, Your Honor, I can hear
you. Okay, I want to make sure you can hear me. Okay. I was just getting into my very interesting hypothetical. Basically, that if let's say a billionaire hired their cousin or nephew or something like that and paid them $200,000 a year, but the cousin met, so they were hired in a family business, but the cousin met the other requirements for TDIU, meaning, you know, just unable to obtain or retain substantially gainful occupation due to service-connected conditions, then this protected environment and marginal employment regulation does allow some – it allows someone who has an income, and it could be a potentially fairly high income, but who would nevertheless meet the requirements for working in a family business, it would allow them to receive that money. Is that correct? So that my point being that the regulation, by including family business, does not, put a money threshold or a income threshold in this part of the regulation?
So, yes, Chief Judge Bartley. So your question, as I interpret it, or maybe if I could rephrase it, is there a point where the income above the poverty level is just so great that it automatically excludes the person from qualifying for TDIU? And the answer is no. It doesn't matter if it's twice as much or 10 times as much as the poverty level. That's not the answer. That's not our position. So perhaps I can phrase it this way. If somebody is earning an income above the poverty level, then that means, at least I don't want to use the word presumption. That's not what the regulation doesn't use that word. I don't want to add words, but that's indicative that the person is able to earn a substantially gainful living. But again, the secretary recognized that, well, we need an exception based on the facts found. And so it doesn't, looking at the amount of income, I would agree, is not dispositive. That's not the point we were trying to make by pointing to the fact that the veteran was earning five times more of the poverty level. The point we're trying to make is that we know that he was actually gainfully employed. So the issue then is, was this a protected environment? What does this case fall within that exception for those people who, for whatever reason, happen to have an income above that level? And our position is that no, this case does not fall within the exception, because the exception is narrow, and it has to be narrow, because otherwise we would get into a really slippery slope of trying to determine when all the different factual circumstances and with subjective determinations about when somebody's accommodations rise to the level of a protected environment. So we're relying on how the phrase protected environment is used in similar contexts. We're asking the court to hold that this is a narrow exception here.
Uh-huh. And let me be clear that by mentioning the hypothetical that I did, it's not that I would sanction that or not. It's just that the regulation by its language would allow someone with a rather high income but whose employment was considered protected to, and they met all the other requirements, to go ahead and get TDIU. At any rate, so your language, proposed language of a non-competitive workplace separated from the open labor market, the appellant called that basically narrowing the reg to a very narrow sliver, and you admit that you have a narrow interpretation. So what's the reason for, what do you mean by non-competitive workplace? Is that like someone from a corporation like Facebook could never, or even a much smaller corporation could never be considered for, under this regulation, for protected employment?
Well, Your Honor, it's difficult to say never, because, and that is kind of the point of the language in this regulation, where it says such as, because we don't quite know what factual circumstances might arise. But I guess to draw the line, or to kind of make a bright line rule, a charitable organization that exists to hire disabled persons would be on the protected environment side of the line. Are there instances where a more traditional employer, competitive employer could? I don't know. But if an employer takes the tax break to hire disabled people under a special program, then that could apply. But that's just not what we have here. We have here a veteran who worked in as a civilian for the Department of Defense, and there's no evidence that he was working in some sort of special program designed specifically for disabled persons. And that's our position here, is that he had a job in the competitive workforce for the government, and that we would argue would never qualify as a protected environment under this regulation.
Now, your inclusion of the term hiring decision in your proposed rule, I found that odd because I don't know. Does this mean that under your proposal, change character or evolve over time such that someone's position could evolve into a protected environment? And I ask that because it seems as though Mr. Arline didn't start out in a protected environment, but over time, this is his argument, as it got worse, then the position became protected. And I guess the use of hiring decision there, does it allow for a position to evolve into one of a protected nature?
The answer is yes, but we would qualify that by saying that it would be a really unusual circumstance. And especially when, again, based on the nature of Mr. Arline's employment, we would argue that could not be the case. So I think your answer or the answer to your question would probably be illustrated best by the family business example, where you have somebody who is hired not because they were necessarily a family member. They were hired because they had skills, but it happened to be a family business. And then at some point, the family business realized that, well, this person has deteriorated and we would not have hired them under these circumstances, but we'll keep them on anyway. That's a little bit different than where Mr. Arline worked, where he would be subject to annual performance reviews and so on. If there were evidence that the job title was recharacterized in a certain way, then perhaps that could qualify. But again, we would say that scenario would be a narrow one. But your point is well taken. I understand your question to be, would a retention, so hiring, yes. What about retention decisions? We would concede that, yes, a decision to retain somebody, the long-time employee scenario, is one that could plausibly qualify. So, yes, that would be our position, but we would argue that would be an unusual circumstance and not one that is present here.
And Mr. Vichich, I'll just continue here. It struck me as rather odd to incorporate the attitude of the boss or the organization into the definition, and I'm referring to the language, the hiring or the retention is motivated by a benevolent attitude. I mean, I have a vivid imagination, obviously. Would this cover an organization that – are we going to be looking into the attitude of the employer? And as I started to say, I could imagine an organization that hires a veteran, maybe perhaps hires someone due to their relationship to someone who's very wealthy or has a lot of prestige or so on, so that the motivation might be different from benevolence in some situations, even where someone's working for a charitable organization, for example. Doesn't that kind of compromise the intent that you seem to have here to cover people who need the protected environment, or they're able to work because it's a protected environment, and yet we start you know, VA could start looking into the intent or attitude of the employer.
Chief Judge Bartley, the use of the word benevolent was what we were trying to highlight, was that in these so-called protected environments, as the term is used by others, not by VA, is referring to usually an organization or some type of program that exists to give the person a job rather than to receive their services. It's in a lot of these cases, we're talking about severely disabled people who cannot work at all, but this gives them a place to go. This gives them dignity to work. And that's what the term protected environment, how it's typically used in other contexts. And again, the secretary is not the first, this regulation is not the first regulation to include the term. So what we were looking at is how is this term used in other contexts that are is similar, involving, you know, employability and so on. So that's why we use that word benevolent, is because we're looking for some sort of factor that shows that the employer is more interested in helping the employee rather than receiving the services of the employee. So that was our position there, and we're basing that on how that term is used in other contexts.
Uh-huh. And I did want to ask you also the question that I asked to appellant's counsel, which is the court bound by its conclusion in Cantrell that the term that we're looking at here is ambiguous? Or did Kaiser affect that?
No, and we would say it's because the court, precisely because the court did not interpret the term. If the court did interpret the term and issue a ruling, then we would say, even if the court said it's ambiguous, here's what we think it should mean or so on, we wouldn't be making this argument here. We would say we have precedent that says this is what it means, and we're not, you know, we're not going to revisit that. So, yes, the court did say it was ambiguous, but the court said, well, but we're not going to determine its meaning now. So now this case is presented, the issue is presented, and the court can determine its meaning, even if the court says continues to conclude, or if it's bound to again say that it is ambiguous, we would at least ask the court to consider our arguments and the reasons to determine that the ambiguity should be resolved in our favor. So we do ask the court to first defer to us under our, and even if it, deference is not warranted, we ask the court to at least defer under Skidmore, even though Skidmore deference isn't truly deference. We would at least ask the court to consider that this is our regulation. This is an area where the Department of Veterans Affairs is given substantial authority to determine when veterans are unable to work due to their service-connected conditions, and we would just ask that the court give a little bit of weight to that factor.
Okay, this is Judge Bartley again. I just want to make sure I understood you as to something you said earlier. The secretary does want to confine this part of the 4.16 to charitable or institutional organizations that are trying to rehabilitate or help people. Is that fair? Is that a fair characterization? It sounds like that's what you were saying.
Correct. That is the interpretation we are offering to the court, yes.
And so anyone in private employment, you seem to hedge a little bit on this, but I'm kind of looking for a yes or no. Anyone in private or public employment, such as Mr. Cantrell was with a park service or an entity like that, and a government entity like that, or some kind of local park service, And Mr. Arline, who was with a branch of DOD, would not qualify under any circumstances?
We're not going to go that far, and I appreciate Your Honor's concern about needing a clear answer and a clear line drawing. And the secretary, this regulation is sort of ground zero for the secretary kind of wanting to be able to apply this on a case-by-case basis. So the answer I could give you would offer today is that we would need some sort of evidence that the employer is maybe receiving a tax deduction or is taking a loss for the purpose of giving this person a job. And it's difficult to specify exactly when that might occur. But we would not rule out the possibility that a regular private employer that's not necessarily a charitable organization could provide a protected environment. We're not willing to, or we're not asking the court to go that far. But we're saying that it's, yes, a theoretical possibility, but we would just emphasize that this case does not present those facts because we don't have that sort of scenario here.
And so under your definition, any consideration of accommodations in any sense would not really be at issue.
That's correct, Chief Judge Bartley, because it would be necessarily a subjective determination and it would be nearly impossible to apply uniformly. I do not have any other points to make that I haven't made yet. So I will, if there are, I guess I will pause for a minute to see if there are any questions from Judges Peach and Falvey.
Yes, this is Judge Peach. The last question that Judge Bartley asked, can you expound on that? I'm not sure I understood your answer that accommodations would have nothing to do with it if this were a benevolent. I mean, could you talk more about that? I don't think I got the full flavor of your answer.
Okay, let me see if I can clarify, Judge Peach. I think what we have in mind for this protected environment, if it would exist in a private employer situation, there would need to be some sort of evidence that that the employer is paying a subsidy, and that some of the materials we cited in our supplemental pleading have the rather complicated calculation for determining subsidy. So if there was some evidence that an employer had a special program went out of its way. I believe my time is up. May I continue?
Right. Sure. Go ahead. We'll give 10 more minutes.
Thank you, Chief Judge Bartley. So if there was some evidence that an employer was specifically hiring disabled persons and receiving for some sort of reason and receiving maybe a government subsidy to do so, that very well could qualify. But as far as an employer who is just making some accommodations and letting the person work, we would argue that no, that would not qualify.
Okay, so the federal government, generally speaking, in these competitive service positions, would not qualify as a protected environment because it's not a program aimed at, these jobs are not aimed at rehabilitation or training of individuals who have a disability. But the federal government has this ADA program that would accommodate anybody with a disability who needs accommodation to a reasonable accommodation.
Correct. I think probably the best way to I would address that is to say that the Americans with Disabilities Act is even more reason to hold that this protected environment exception is narrow. There should be very few reasons that this would even apply, because the Americans with Disabilities Act was a major policy shift to try to get disabled persons out of that segregated employment and get them into the competitive environment. So this protected environment concept is an old one, and this is something we added 30 years ago. It was before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, and so yes, we would agree, or I would highlight that workplaces in the federal government that even if under the ADA would not qualify under this protected environment exception.
As well as it would project out to non-federal government employees, private industry or state government or institutions like academic institutions, if the ADA, if the Americans with Disabilities Act applied to them as well.
That is correct, yes.
Do you think in this case the supervisor, I'm not sure, let me ask, was it in this case the supervisor who made the, quote, unreasonable accommodation because he himself was a veteran?
That is what the appellant said. I don't believe we had any statements in the record from the supervisor, but that was the veteran's explanation, and the board did not reject outright everything Mr. Arline said. It was the extent of how he explained it. That was the problem.
If the definition is one that involves an unreasonable accommodation, and if Mr. Arline were still employed full-time by the Department of Defense in that position, practically speaking, assuming he received TDIU, what is the effect of that? What are we looking at, practically speaking? Is the status quo or additional compensation?
I'm not sure I understand your question. You're saying if VA awarded TDIU to Mr. Arline, would that
he was still working? Maybe I'm not understanding. Mr. Arline is requesting TDIU because he was forced into retirement, is what he's sort of saying. So what's the practical effect? Does that mean that he would get an increase in his pension, or would he still would? I don't seem to understand what this would involve.
I guess I'm not sure I understand what you're asking. I mean, there's nothing preventing VA from awarding TDIU. It's just we're just asking the court to hold that the circumstances he have described don't fit the criteria.
Okay. In a protected environment for the family-owned business or the sheltered workshop, do these entities traditionally provide perks for the individual who is participating in this employment? You know, things like retirement, leave, things like that. Do they pay Social Security?
I do not know. I do not know, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
Okay, thank you, Judge Beach.
Hi, this is Judge Salvi. I have
I have a couple questions. So the definition that you've provided us in your supplemental brief, the board didn't have the benefit of that definition. Do we need to send it back to them to consider it initially?
No, because this is a question of law. This court routinely addresses questions of law in the first instance. The board does not possess the authority to issue. And may I continue, Your Honor?
Well, yes, we'll add 10 minutes to your time.
Thank you. Yes, the board does not have the authority to issue legal binding legal precedent. So,
they do have to apply the facts to the definition to find out if the veteran meets the definition.
That is true, Your Honor, but the board made all the necessary factual findings here. I'm sorry, did I speak over you?
No, I'm still here.
Okay, I'm getting some feedback. Yes, the board made all the necessary factual findings here, and there's no need to send it back for more explanation.
Do we need to reach the question related to 4.16 if we don't find the board erred in its credibility determination?
No, Your Honor, you do not. And that's why the Secretary is asking the court to, again, review that credibility determination. And if it finds it to not be clearly erroneous, then the court does not need to get to the legal interpretation of in a protected environment. And that's exactly what the court has already done in its vacated memorandum decision.
Now, Mr. Vicic, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, Judge Fowley, if you had another question. I just wanted some clarification on that point. So he filed his TDIU application in 2015. He retired in 2014, but he reached the 70% in 2011. And of course, although he filed the formal application in 2015, it's certainly possible that. He could argue further downstream, of course, not here, that the issue of TDIU had been raised prior to his formal application. Now, just in terms of what we would or wouldn't have to do here, would we still, though, have to determine, let's say we agreed with you on credibility as to the work environment, but he stopped and the protected employment. He stopped working in 2014. We would still have to address or decide the issue of TDIU entitlement after January 2014. Is that correct in your view?
Well, the board denied TDIU outright. It didn't separate different periods. So, and the court in its memorandum decision adjudicated the two issues separately, the increased rating issue and the TDIU issue. So that's what we're asking the court to do here. And we don't see any reason the court could not do that here. I mean, the court can affirm TDIU and the other issue can go back and still be adjudicated, re-adjudicated again.
Okay, thank you.
Let me ask another question. Why should we defer either our or Skidmore to the definition you're proposing and not view it just as a litigation position or a post hoc rationalization or unfair surprise, just remand or reverse based on that?
Well, if A few reasons, Your Honor. First is, the Secretary has in previous cases been reluctant to try to give a precise definition for this term, and the court has rejected those arguments. So we're trying to help the court get to the meaning of this regulation by giving it the tools it needs to determine in the first instance what these words mean without needing to defer to either party. So that's what we're attempting to do here in the post-Kaiser situation. But as far as even if the court does find this ambiguous, we would at least ask the court to hold that this is a reasonable interpretation, even though this is the first time we've articulated it. In the past, we've tried to say, well, we're not sure. Well, it's kind of a case-by-case determination, but we're trying to help the court here and give the court something concrete that it can sink its teeth into. So we ask that the court consider that that those changed circumstances, like Ray, Cantrell, Kaiser, those cases sort of have given the general counsel's office certainly a reason to be more precise when it advances litigation positions, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Vichich, this is Judge Bartley. I just want to ask you one more question here. I believe that the board took into account the veterans on volunteer work with VA. This is all, I believe, in their their post-retirement consideration of TDIU. They took into account the veterans volunteering with VA and his activities in a church, I believe. So why should VA be allowed to consider that, given our decision in FERCIA and various other cases that things that don't, things like, for the VA work, he said he could show up he could take off and not show up. It was just the same as like showing up, really. It's a totally volunteer position, and there were no real requirements made of him other than to wheel veterans around and things like that. So why should the VA be allowed to consider those kinds of activities that somehow akin to substantially gainful occupation?
Well, Your Honor, the board's required to look at all the evidence of record. So when it's pointing to those facts, if the board had said pointed only to that and said you're able to do work because you volunteered at the VA, that would be a different case. But just by identifying those things to support its analysis, that is a proper consideration. It's ultimately the veteran must present evidence of unemployability. The board does not have the burden of disproving the claim. So when the board looks to all the evidence and looks at these factors, and that ultimately is what gives this court the explanation it needs to review the board's factual findings on the clearly erroneous standard.
And so in your view, in the Secretary's view, when the board, I'm looking at it now on page 21 of the ROP, I believe, was reviewing, so they didn't have any work, employed, full-time employed work to look at after 2015, and they looked at his volunteer work in his church activities. In your view, that's okay because it's essentially he didn't prove his entitlement during that period?
That's correct, Your Honor. He retired. The board looked at that, and the board said it in one part of its decision that there was no change from when he was working with after he retired. That's on page 24 of the record before the agency. It's this first full paragraph that says the board finds that the evidence does not indicate that the veteran has been rendered unemployable by those service-connected disabilities in the years since his retirement. And so the board was looking at the big picture while he was working and after he was working. And I believe my time is up, so I will just conclude by asking the court to affirm the board's denial of TDIU.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vicic. Ms. Donahauer, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The two primary flaws in the Secretary's argument are, first, that his interpretation eliminates all paths to fact-found marginal employment except for sheltered employment. And as to the board's credibility finding, the uncontradicted evidence here is that the veteran's employment was protected, and it's not just his word, it's the vocational expert's endorsement of the reported accommodations that he received. As to the Secretary's reliance on Social Security and IRS uses of the word protected to describe sheltered employment, there are a couple of problems. First, other agencies' interpretations of terms that they use do not shed light on what under the rules and steps of regulatory interpretation do not shed light on what a term in 4.16 VA's regulation means. And in any case, both of the examples attached to the Secretary's supplemental pleading simply show that a sheltered workshop is only one example of protected work, or conversely, that a protected environment is a characteristic of a sheltered workshop. They're not coextensive with each other. I want to clarify also a matter about the board's credibility finding. As far as the Secretary has argued that there's some kind of inconsistency in his reporting of the accommodations he received, he noted that his recent affidavit, as the board said, was sort of a departure from his prior descriptions, but that's simply not true. As far back as 2007, he said his supervisor was having someone help him do his work, just as he did in 2017. That's on page 2100 of the record. But in any case, we don't, again, just have the veteran's statements about his accommodations here. We have the endorsement of an expert who relied on her expertise to validate what he said. Limiting a protected work environment to a sheltered workshop is simply not valid because it's contrary to the unambiguous meaning of the regulation. And I would also say here that as to deference, not only is this interpretation advanced for the first time here, but it's a narrowing, as I said in my opening statement, it's a narrowing from what the board said. The board said on page 22 of the record that extraordinary accommodation could demonstrate that the veteran was unemployable because he worked in a protected environment. And the court, that is an appropriate interpretation of what a protected environment is, unlike the one that the Secretary is advancing today. And given that there's no evidence that that was not the case under Mr. Arline's facts, the court should reverse the board's determination that his employment environment was not protected. Finally, I just wanted to touch on a couple of the practical considerations that your honors raise. As to Judge Peach's question about the practical effects here, the award of TDIU would mean a retroactive payment of benefits for the period when he was working, as to the difference between his scheduler rating and the TDIU rate. And in the meantime, he will have had the dignity of working during that time period up until his retirement. And also as to when a TEIU rating is warranted, from what date. His increased rating claim for schizophrenia dates back to 2006, as we noted on page 2 of the opening brief. And the uncontroverted vocational evidence is that he was incapable of substantially gainful employment from 2006. So there's nothing factually to resolve as far as the period prior to the formal application for individual unemployability. And I would just note that the Secretary seemed to agree that the decision to retain a long-term employee could be a protected environment, and that's what happened here. Mr. Arline worked for the Defense Supply Center for a number of years before his schizophrenia started to worsen and he became unable to meet the demands of his job. His supervisor, who by that point had a relationship with him, understood that and made accommodations for it. So by that interpretation, his environment would be protected. So for those reasons, we ask the court to interpret protected work environment to include unreasonable accommodations and hold that the board's finding that the veteran's work environment was not protected here was both contrary to law because it was not based on evidence and also clearly erroneous, and reverse the board's denial of TDIU because the only competent evidence showed that he was incapable of substantially gainful employment. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both very much for your argument. The case is submitted for consideration, and the court is adjourned. Thank you.
The court is in recess.